All right. Let's take a few minutes. We'll meditate together for a few minutes. Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master, Paramhansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, humbly we bow to you all. Help us to attune ourselves to your divine presence within, that all that we do may be a true expression of your will. Om peace. Amen. We'll meditate now for a few minutes. Om peace. Amen. Yes, I've been away, as you all know, mostly know. Do you all know? I mean, I was caring for a friend who is dying, who is still living, unbelievably, against all laws of the physical world. She still breathes, and I don't know why, and no one knows why. There's a book that Swami Kriyananda wrote, which I suppose is out of print because I didn't find it downstairs. It's called Art as a Hidden Message, A Guide to Self-Realization, which I'm sure you can find either through Crystal Clarity or through Amazon, some old copy of it. And it's very interesting, and there's sort of, I'm sort of thinking that there's a whole lot of different ways to approach this subject, and I think I'll just sort of go in all of them, because the very first time I ever gave this class, which was like, must have been even 20 years ago, I had two professional ballet dancers, several professional singers. I mean, I had a room full of professional artists or people who were near professional. So we had this whole different discussion because everybody was engaged on an everyday basis, you know, with the facts of creativity. So it gave us a completely different orientation. It also gave me a false idea of how I could teach this class, which I've never really, it's never really come back to that, because it was such a unique situation. What we're working with here is more what everybody is working with, which is just sort of this balance point between the ordinary demands of everyday life and this concept that we call creativity, which kind of floats around out there. Creativity, and especially art, well, creativity of all kinds, and I'm going to make some distinctions here, it's a very important part of the path of self-realization. And I think I'm just going to start sort of from the fundamental, where it applies to all of us. You know, my particular artistic endeavor is mostly writing, but I tinker with a few other things just for the fun of it, but the one that I do seriously is writing. But all of it is, creativity as a whole is a way of life. Let me just sort of try to figure out how to say this. Swami Kriyananda, there's two factors, two ways that Swami has used the word creativity that I think are really relevant to this discussion. The first one was interesting many years ago when Ananda was only Ananda Village. This was in the 70s. And we had a lot of land and, 50 or so people, and just a tremendously complicated and very expensive project that we didn't know how we were ever going to succeed at doing. And we were all just kind of shooting in the dark trying to figure out how to make the thing work. And the whole concept of prosperity was a big issue because we were really broke. I mean, broke on levels that's hard to imagine, but less broke than you would be here, because we had a lot of land and we could sort of all live on it. So if you can basically live together and have shelter and you're not going to get evicted, you can be much poorer than if you're going to get evicted. I mean, it's a whole difference. So the lack of cash is less of an issue if you have shelter. So we were extremely cash poor, but all we had to do was make that mortgage every month and we could still sort of stay where we were. And there were enough of us together that we could usually manage, we always managed that. And at that time in the 70s, there was a lot of, this was the beginning of a lot of New Age thinking and manifesting principles and all of these sorts of things. And there were lots of prosperity teachers and methods all over the place happening in the world. And so some of the people at Ananda started like bringing in some of these courses. We were going to do all this stuff to make ourselves prosperous. And I kept thinking that certainly Master's teachings have something about prosperity. We don't have to go to the Unity Church. They couldn't possibly know something that Master didn't know. And so in that context, there was this phrase, we have to get over what people called poverty consciousness. And I tend to be kind of a realist, almost to a fault, really to a fault. Swami's criticized me for it, for being just too unwilling to see beyond the obvious. But it didn't seem to me like we had poverty consciousness. It seemed to me like we had little rich kid consciousness in my mind, because we expected to just be able to sit there and have money come to us, which is what people do when they're raised wealthy, not when they're raised poor. People who are raised poor know that you have to work for everything that you get, and you have to work hard for it, and they have a very, poor people have a very clear relationship between how hard you work and how much money you have. Whereas rich kids and rich people do not, especially rich kids don't, because they haven't worked for it. Their parents have worked for it, and it's provided for them, and they have very little connection in their mind between energy expended and financial return. And to my mind, it's one of the, well, I'm not the only one who says it, but it's one of the tragedies of our age, is that it's not so much that children are privileged. I mean, it's great if you have artistic talent to be able to have music lessons and, you know, to be able to attend a school that's interesting and fun for you. I mean, all that is fine. But when you don't understand the relationship between energy output and result, then you're crippled. And when you don't understand the relationship between energy output and income, then you're crippled. It's very serious. When we started our school 25 years ago, whenever we started now, we were just saying, you know, what are the things we'd really like children to know when they come out of our school? And one of them, to me, which seemed primary, was the relationship between work and money. Because not understanding the relationship between work and money, again, you're crippled. You spend your whole life thinking that something's wrong somewhere when it's really just, you yourself just don't get this. And you think that somebody owes you something. And it's actually the way much is going on right now, it's being made much worse. Rather than being made better, it's actually being made worse and worse for various complicated reasons. I mean, Gary, in our middle school, because he was raised by a hardworking man, and the three boys in his family were all raised to work. They always understood. His father ran a steel yard. He started a business which became quite successful, but the boys all worked. They worked in the yard, and they knew how to... Some of it was physical and some of it was managerial, but they understood you put out energy and something comes back. And when we would do our field trips and so on for the middle school, he wanted the kids to earn at least some of the money. And he thought it was important if they were going to take this trip that they should at least be engaged in earning it. But the parents didn't want it to interfere with soccer, piano, tutoring, math tutoring, you know. And I don't want to cast aspersions where they don't really belong, but it was not as obvious to the parents why the children needed to work for what they were going to get, because they were so busy building their resumes for college that, you know, that was sort of really the priority that was there rather than... I mean, when I was growing up, it was just very common to have a job. But now they actually, really, many parents don't want their children to have jobs because they need to study and they need to build their resumes. And, you know, building their character is not always in there, and it's not serving us well. Well, in any case, I felt at Ananda that we had little rich kid consciousness because we just somehow thought. And then you get these, I mean, I'm on prosperity, and I'll get into creativity, but you'll see. Then you get into these, many prosperity systems are quite valid, but some of them are, like Swami said, it's like having tea with your dolls, some of it. It's, you know, it's fun, but it's just imagination because, again, the concept becomes, all I have to do is visualize this. I just keep visualizing it, and somehow that's going to do it for me. Now, it's subtle because there's a tremendous manifesting power. You have a manifesting power of your own consciousness, but people tend to think, and as it happens, like, today is Saturday, so it was a week ago, I've been doing this webinar series for online with Ananda, and I've been doing Swami Kriyananda's 26 Keys to Higher Awareness. And I recently did, I think it was number 14, but it might have been number 15. But it was affirmations, be affirmative, be positive. And it was really interesting to me, very interesting to me, I hope it was interesting to others. I finally actually got, I was able to just see in simple words, the fulcrum point about what I like and don't like about affirmations. And it helps me, it was very helpful to me, and this is it, simply. What you get in life is a result of the energy you put out. It's as simple as that. Of course, karma, it plays a role in it, because sometimes you put out terrific energy, but you're balancing something karmically, and it just doesn't work for you as well as it should until that karma is balanced. There's a story that Swami tells about a disciple, the brother of a disciple at Mount Washington. And that man, no matter what he tried, he could never make any money. And Master, the way Swami writes it, is Master de-jinxed him. He just had a karmic obstacle, and Master took away the karmic obstacle. He called it de-jinxing him. But then his good work began to bring prosperous results. But sometimes people, in lieu of actually putting out work, energy, just start with affirmations, as if the affirmation was a magic formula. That's the word that I finally came up with. Merely to see yourself, you know, drowning in money, it's just wishful thinking. And what Swami wrote in this tiny little three-sentence thing about affirmations that I spoke on was that an affirmation is a way of giving form and clarity to your determination. It's not something other than your determination. It's just a very good and a very positive, and I've used affirmations, a very positive way of concentrating that energy and using it in the right direction. But just merely to visualize yourself as being this or that, I am a healer, I am a writer, I am a great singer, unless you take voice lessons and practice and learn the music, nothing is going to happen. And so some prosperity things are just all based on as if it was a magic formula. Now, these are delicate, and this is, I'm shifting subjects here slightly, but only a little. You do have to have, you need to give the right form and substance to your determination, and you can work against yourself with wrong thoughts. That's definitely true. Your thoughts are very powerful materializing force, but only if you actually put energy behind them, not if you think that now I'm just going to say this and everything's going to be fine. There has to be a clear relationship. So when I was asking Swamiji about prosperity, I said, Swami, certainly Master's teachings, you know, has teachings for prosperity. We don't need to go to all these different folks who were teaching us at that time. And Swami said, the secret of prosperity is creativity. And he just gave me, just like one-to-one, just like that. And it was extremely interesting answer to me. And he said, because creativity says, if this doesn't work, I'll try that. And if that doesn't work, I'll try something else. And if that doesn't work, I'll try this. And I'll just keep going until I find the one that works. And of course, that is also the relationship between energy output and energy return. But it's also working not merely just like a shudra, just without any, I'll just keep doing the same thing that I'm doing and hope that something will happen. It also is the ability to see a situation for what it is and then make a realistic decision based on what's going on around you. I mean, an example Swami often uses, and this is also balancing between affirmation and positive and creativity, is, well, a friend of mine, a young man with a tremendous natural athletic ability, was in a motorcycle accident, and he was just a mile from his home, just on his own road, and some careless person driving the car, you know, like people do, reached down, drifted across the lane, and just sheared like that, just right, you know, on one side. And so this poor young man is lying on the street with his leg completely smashed. And he actually he knew he had a choice because he was bleeding so badly. It was, his angels came and said, basically, do you want to live or die? Because he could have just died on the street so simply. And they said, you know, you're not going to come out of this hole. He said, it's all right. I still want to live. So they took him to the hospital, and he was conscious enough to say, I'm an athlete. Take it off below the knee. You've got to save my knee. And they managed to save his knee, took his leg off from here. And it was, you know, a tough recovery. He actually won the gold medal in the Paralympic snowboarding. Evan Strong is his name. Because he really is that good, even with only part of a leg. He was going to try to cross over and compete in the full able-bodied. I don't know if he's been able to or not.
Yeah, like across
the mm-hmm. But he's just so good and determined. And now, the point of that was, oh yes, if you've lost a limb, you can just lie in your bed and affirm that you're able-bodied all you want. Master himself says, if you have enough will, you can regenerate your own limbs. I haven't yet met anyone who's able to do that, but I'm sure that it can be done, because in theory it can be done. But if you just keep affirming that I'm whole and then stand up again and don't have two legs, you're going to fall over. But if you say, okay, this is what I'm working with now. And what I'm working with now is that below the knee there's no body anymore, so I have to find the right prosthetic, I have to learn how to use it, I have to figure out who I am now that this has happened. Now, we can look at something like that, but we can also say, I'm a married man, my wife has her own realities, I have a son, I have a daughter, you know, taking care of the family requires this. Or we can spend all our time chafing against the conditions of our life and imagine somehow that that's going to bring us what we want. You know, we have to be creative in a way that is related to the circumstances that we have. And there's a lot of steps involved in coming to that. We have to trust our own karma and realize that if I've been brought to this condition, you know, sincerely, even if I was brought to this condition unconsciously, as many of us are, you know, we make decisions at a certain point in our life, and sometimes people with more experience try to tell us those are not the best decisions in the world to make, and sometimes the people who have more experience push us into those decisions. I got a phone call, it amuses me, Kamal, when you say this, I'm not a phone call, I got an email, some man found my classes on the internet, we've been corresponding, he writes back and he says, I'm Indian, so of course I'm an engineer. He said, my parents would not have it any other way. He said, but what I really do is make films. And then he sent me this little film. I met an Indian woman. She was, as it just happened, just to make it all the more amazing, she was a very delicate, you know, just almost, just extremely delicate, very, very pretty and very petite, very small, very light. She was a petroleum engineer. She was getting her, you know. And it was more like, how did you possibly end up there? But there was no point in asking. I knew how she ended up there. Somebody in her family calculated, you know, where she ought to be. So she's out there being a petroleum engineer.
It's very relevant.
Well, I understand it. You know, when the parent has struggled. You see, and the irony of it is, this is what I figured out about my parents at one point. My parents, well, let me think about this, how to say this exactly. I don't know whether they would have liked to have influenced me. I was beyond their influence, so I don't really know. But I truthfully think their idea of parenting was, we were American Jews, and it was just different. Could somebody bring me a tissue? I seem to be very, very caught up in my throat. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I hope the whole box isn't required, but we'll see. Excuse me for just a minute here. But I was saying about my parents. My parents, in our particular family, individuality and nonconformity to a certain extent was prized. That's kind of, Jews go both ways. Jews are either, you know, a rabbi, a lawyer, a doctor, or you can be a radical, or just something unusual. I took the unusual, but regardless of what my parents would have thought, I did it anyway. When I was in Bangalore, having a satsang with friends there, with our Ananda group, they asked me about my coming to Ananda, and I told them when I was 22, I met Swamiji and made the decision I was going to move to Ananda Village, and a year and a half later, I just did. I just went. And they looked at me and they said, "What did your parents think?" I said, "I didn't ask them." And they went, you know, it was just like unthinkable that I wouldn't have asked them. And I said, and even if they hadn't approved, I would have done it. I just didn't know what else to say. I said, what can I do? I'm American. This is our way. But I wasn't born Indian because that just wasn't my karma. But my karma was independence and so on, so here I am. But the end point is, whether or not it was forced on us by others, and I'm going to actually go back to the Indian thing, because when I haven't been traveling for a couple of years, but for a couple of years I was going to India for some time and speaking in our Ananda groups and getting to know our groups over there. And the whole thing of having your life be so guided by others is quite alien to my temperament. Quite apart from being American, it's quite alien to my temperament. And the way I finally came to understand it is, it's a battle I fought a long time ago, and I'm very extremely forceful in it. Even when I would read novels, I read lots of novels as a child, any novel where the theme was based on society or family forcing a person to do things, I would just become irate. You know, just, why don't they just stand up and just tell them to go away and just do what they want? You know, just like way strong. And so when I would be dealing with Indian women especially, this one woman, she really helped me enormously. Very successful career woman, creative in the textile business, very strong, you know. And I just said something like, "It's your life." She just laughed right at me. She says, "Of course it's not my life. It belongs to my children first, then it belongs to my husband, then it belongs to my in-laws, and then to my mother. It's not mine." And there was no resentment in her. She thought what I was saying was preposterous, just completely preposterous. And I got it when she said that to me. You know, I understood. Well, that's just a whole other way of looking. Or you're caught in a situation where everybody else is making you do what you don't feel in your heart to do, because it's time for you to learn to stand up for yourself. And so either things can be true. It just depends on the karma of the moment. Because when I was having to talk to some of these women, they used the most... mostly women I would end up talking to, and mostly it was, "My parents are arranging this marriage for me, but I don't want to cooperate with it." I said, "What did Swami Kriyananda say when women said that to him?" He said, "It's your life." And that was like, okay, because that's be what I would be inclined to say. Nobody is a victim. It's your life. Your karma may be that you're facing a very tough choice, but that still doesn't make it not your choice. Now, in the Ask Asha book, this woman wrote me, you know, this marriage is being arranged for me and so on and so on, and I have to go along. I said, well, if you're old enough to be married, that probably means you're ambulatory. It probably means that you can read and write. You can probably get your own passport, and I bet you can get a job. So what you're actually telling me is it's highly inconvenient. But you are perfectly capable of walking out on this situation, so let's be realistic. What's really going on here? Now, these are extreme examples, but you find yourself married with children and a mortgage and all of these other things. Don't think for a minute that this wasn't all your doing. And therefore, if it's your doing, then you will never progress in any way that actually counts until you start by just on a very deep level saying, my leg is cut off below the knee now. And if I still had both my legs, I would live in a certain way. But I don't, because I chose to ride a motorcycle, whatever it might be. Or because I incarnated as a human being and I accepted my karma. So there's you have to work with the materials at hand. And no amount of affirmation or rebellion against the materials at hand are going to change the materials at hand. And where creativity comes in is when you say, this is what I have to work with. And so how do I move forward? That poor woman who wrote me, I don't think she ever wrote me back. I finally answered her by saying, you know, in this particular case, I edited my answer, so what she actually got from me was less clear than when I ended up in the book. But I said, you know, she didn't want to marry this particular man because he wasn't her soulmate. She was hoping to marry her soulmate, which I have a certain respect for people being each other's soulmates and a certain skepticism, but it's just what people go through. I say, well, you know, maybe he'll turn out to be a lot nicer than you think he is because, you know, unless your parents are really stupid or evil, they may actually be making a good selection for you here. So he'll either turn out to be much nicer than you think and you'll really find this is a nice marriage, or it'll be a terrible marriage and that's what it'll be either way. And I said, in any case, you'll get the marriage that's appropriate for you. And if this one doesn't work, there's always the next one. And I said, I'm sure this is very small comfort for you.
No wonder she never wrote back.
Yeah, that's exactly. It makes a good book, but not a good letter when you're receiving it. I wrote more sympathetically, but the fact is, where karma is our karma, and if we don't like it, we're not going to get out of it. Swami used to say this to me: you don't get out of karma by doing it badly. And that's sort of like the way you feel inside. I'm just going to rebel against this karma, and by rebelling against it, I'll show how I'm above it somehow. But no, that actually doesn't work that way. And so the creativity, prosperity, now we can talk on all levels as well as just money, is just continually finding a way within you to reinvent yourself and what you're doing, either within the circumstances that you find yourself in, or by actually being able to change those circumstances. And is this easy? No. That's why most people in the world are not prosperous. Because real prosperity is an energy exchange. And then there's prosperity on many different levels. So creativity, now to, you know, tying creativity to prosperity in that way, the real question is, what is creativity itself? What is it to be creative? Now, I was starting to say, Swamiji approaches the subject of creativity and art from several different angles. And we're not really using the book as a textbook, but it's a very interesting book to read. It's been creativity in the arts and the purpose of art in life and society has been an interest of Swamiji since he was very, very young. When he was even like when he was 15 or 16, by the time he was in college, he tells this story himself, that he was taking a course, and he was asked, to define their personal criteria of greatness in artistic endeavor. And Swamiji had a revelation. It wasn't like he didn't have an insight. He had an actual revelation. Einstein had a revelation. I mean, Einstein didn't figure out how the universe worked. He just suddenly saw how it worked. And then he had to spend many years taking that revelation and then filling in the scientific and logical and mathematical steps between apparent reality and the reality he'd perceived. I mean, that's a revelation. I'm going to tell you a very long joke here. There was the devil and one of his smaller junior assistants were walking down the street, and they saw a very saintly person in front of him, and they could sense that that saintly person was about to have a revelation of divine truth. And the junior devil said to the senior devil, "We've got to do something. We can't let this guy just have this revelation of truth. We need to interrupt him." And the senior devil said, "Don't worry, I got it covered." And then it just got closer and closer, and the junior devil's getting very agitated, and the senior devil's just completely calm. Finally, this saintly person has a full revelation, and he sees the truth of reality, and then he begins to preach, and people begin to listen to him, and the junior devil says, "Well, you should have done something while we could still do something." And the senior devil said, "Don't worry." He said, "Now that he's had the revelation, I'm just going to organize it for him." Because we have the first look at it, and then we just bring it down. But Swami had a real look, and he had a real look at what art really is, and what the role of the role of the artistic expression in self-development and self-realization, which is how I began to understand it later, and what constitutes great art. So he wrote his college essay, and he described the quality of light that emanates from a piece of art determines its greatness. And he talked about my mind goes blank at the moment, but I think the light of Shakespeare, the light of Chaucer, the light of Homer's Iliad, and the different qualities of light. And he talked about how Homer's Iliad, to him, he couldn't exactly understand it, but it emanated a great white light, and therefore he knew it was based on, he got an F on his essay. His professor thought he was completely out of his mind, but Swami knew he wasn't. He knew that there was a vibration of consciousness that is manifested through artistic work, and that the level of that vibration determines its greatness. And it might not be obvious to everyone, but it's why some endures and uplifts, and everybody is drawn back to it, because the truth it expresses is of such a high level that all human beings can find it. And he started at that point trying to write out what this revelation meant to him. He actually wrote it 7 times. And there were 7 different iterations of this essay until he finally, and different names, the meaning in the arts, art as a hidden message, the artist as a channel, several others. He had about 4 different titles and 7 different iterations before he finally got to Art as a Hidden Message, which is a bit of a hidden message for a title. But as he said, Swami said it was the best he could come up with, because what he's saying is that artistic expression has a message in it, and that message is the consciousness of the person who creates it. And that consciousness presents a world view and an understanding of life. And Swami felt, you know, very importantly, that art is a very important part of the social fabric. Because if art is constantly presenting a certain understanding of reality and communicating a certain consciousness, then society will be influenced in that direction. As Swamiji said, it not only reflects consciousness, it also creates it. Now, there was a time when Michael Jackson, before his life dissolved into such scandal and so on, was universally, you know, globally revered and admired, as everybody thought he was wonderful. And Swamiji had never heard of him living the life that he lives. And when some of the teenagers in our community heard that Swami had never even heard of, what to speak of heard, Michael Jackson, they decided that he really needed to be informed. So somebody selected a couple of what they thought were the best examples, and they sent it to Swami to listen to. And, you know, hearing what a worldwide phenomenon he was, Swami became interested, and he listened to him. And it was very interesting, his response. First of all, Swami said, He's a consummate artist. He's absolutely masterful at doing what he's setting out to do. You couldn't do what he's trying to do any better than he does it. He's perfect at it. He knows exactly what he wants to say, and he says it perfectly. He said also he's completely on the same vibration as the planet is. He's just right tuned into where people are. And that's why, of course, he's so phenomenal, because he puts across the consciousness that people are wanting. And Swami said what this told Swami also about himself is that he is totally out of tune with the consciousness of this planet and that he has no interest in communicating to where people are now. Swami's only interest is in communicating to where they could go. And I mean, in a real, very real sense, everything Swami has done is for a higher age than the one we're in. That the way I think about it is, Swamiji has created an entire culture of self-realization. It covers every aspect of life. And a handful of people right now care. But in time, whether that's decades or generations, I really don't know, everyone will care. And when they care, they'll turn and they'll see that it's there. And in a real sense, you realize it's better to be a little bit ahead, because if you're speaking to what is, even just in another sense, because this is an energy universe, if it's already there, it's already over. Because everything is always moving. That's why these pop sensations rise and fall. They hit just right where it is, but that's where it already is. And then it starts moving, and then it moves away from them. There was a man, Roger Hodgson is his name. He's having a resurging solo career now. He was one of the key songwriters and singers for a group called Supertramp, which was globally number one for a while. This was some decades ago. And Roger became involved with Ananda. He's still a friend, but he's not involved as he was at that time. And Swamiji heard his music and, you know, really, he really respected him artistically, in the sense that Roger worked very hard for what he did and was very clear about what he was trying to do and was very successful at it as a result. His singing style was a little nasal, and his poetry was like that kind of poetry would be, a little obscure. So Swamiji wanted to help him, and he suggested that he could just help Roger a little bit with voice placement. And he also said, you know, he could help him a little bit with the poetry to make it just a little less obscure. And Roger was astute enough to say to Swamiji first how grateful he was that Swami took such an interest in him and how touched he was that he was willing to help him. But if he allowed Swami to do either of those things, it would destroy his career. Because that tone of voice and those songs that implied more than they actually expressed, that was what people wanted. Shift it to what Swami was doing and it would all be over for him. And he just wasn't interested in ending his career at that point. Because art is, you know, it's about consciousness and whether or not it reaches people and who it's going to reach. So the other thing that Swamiji put forward, and he put it forward finally in the last book, which was very interesting, the last version of the book, which was that creative self-expression is an essential quality for spiritual success, which was, he hadn't ever put it quite that clearly before. And not everyone is artistic, or even if you're artistic, not everyone is talented. So it's not that everybody can make a living being an artist, but the point is the capacity to look at reality and feel how you as a unique individual can participate in that reality with conscious self-determination is an essential quality on the spiritual path. Because this world is not going toward God, the material world. Maya is not going toward God. And if you just get in the stream and ride it, then you'll just end up dead again and having to start over. But that doesn't necessarily mean you have to look different. But it means that you have to approach everything with a unique attitude of creativity. And artistic creativity is a helpful means to help you develop that capacity and may be an end in itself. But regardless, you have to become an artist. And now, I'm going to just take a break at this point, and then we'll come back. We can have questions or go on from there. So let's take about 10 minutes. All right? But it's from the point of view of Master, very emphatically and strongly saying that India and America are going to lead the world. Yes. I mean, he says that many times. East and West will unite, and it's India and America. And, you know, I'm quoting him. I don't want to be chauvinistic or narrow, but it is what he says, and he says it many times. And so I stand back and think, well, how is that going to happen? And you're just watching it happen. You're watching it happen by circumstances. Okay, this is all about what we're talking about, and then I'm going to take your questions. It's like God is in charge, and circumstances don't happen just by chance. It's not just by chance that it's not really just because the Indian government should have built more universities, which is what people want to say. And maybe the Indian government should have built more universities. But the fact is that something else is really trying to happen here. And it's just busting apart all these old systems. Now, what you can see, what's easy to see in a big thing, you have to realize is also true in the microcosm of me, which is wherever I am and whatever I'm facing, however unfair or I wish it were different, nonetheless, this is where I stand, and this is the fulcrum point, you know, from which I have to leverage my next reality, because you don't get out of karma by doing it badly. You just have to find a creative way to be prosperous on all levels, given what I've got. Now, do I think that's simple? No. I mean, so easy to say, and it's very, very challenging to do. But that's where we are. Okay, now let me ask questions. We had 1, 2, 3 questions. Okay. Kamal, did you have the first?
I didn't say my question, but my question was, it's unrelated to this topic. Is intuition and God speaking the same?
Intuition and God speaking the same. It's very related, actually, to the subject of creativity, so I'll come back to it, but I'll answer it generally here. People tend to talk about needing to be guided from inside, and we want to hear the inner voice. You know, I want to know what's right for me. I want to feel. And the thing is that the pronoun I applies to many dimensions. We have many levels within ourselves. And I haven't actually put that up on the board yet, but I will eventually. We have what I'll call the subconscious, which I don't mean it exactly the way they mean it in psychology, although it's similar. The subconscious is absolutely everything that you have already done. It's the karmic memory of all of your incarnations, everything that you've already accomplished, that's already happened, that's influencing you now. That's your subconscious influence.
Is it chitta?
Pardon me?
Is it the chitta?
No, chitta. No, chitta is the quality of feeling, which is the direct experience of your life. Subconscious is more like the what you've programmed the computer to do. It's like the computer appears to have, to my mind, a personality that is often antagonistic toward mine. It's trying to thwart me in my efforts, but the computer is completely programmed to do certain things, and it will simply keep doing them. Your subconscious mind is everything that you've ever thought and ever done that's created a certain orientation toward life, expectations, and it's all sitting there. In other words, it's not bad, it's just already done. The superconscious is the part of you that's expanding, potentially all the way to infinity, but whatever expansion it is, whatever capability you have to learn and be something new, it comes from the superconscious. The conscious mind is where we stand while those two forces compete. The subconscious mind tells you, I'm an obedient daughter, I must always do what my parents say, what would happen to me if I didn't just go along You know, I have to do what I've always been told to do. The superconscious mind says, oh, you have limitless potential. You could just get a passport and walk out the door. You know, it's enticing you. Or you can say, I'm a victim. Nobody understands me. Everybody is wrong because it's what you've always thought. Or you can say, maybe God has a plan for me. So, and we're always fighting against this. We're always standing in the middle, being influenced by the habit of what we've always done, being enticed by the new reality. Now, if you do something that is very in tune with what you've always done, it often really feels right because it's so comfortable. And so people will say, I'm being inwardly guided, and you are being inwardly guided. And it's not necessarily wrong just to continue on as you've always been. But when you say that I feel it, it feels right to me, it can feel right to you from many different levels. So even when you use the word intuition, there's subconscious intuition, there's conscious, sort of semi-conscious intuition, there's superconscious intuition. And so you have to know which among those you're really following. I know this man once came to Swami and he really wanted Swami to endorse a certain plan that he had. And Swami just said, I just don't feel it's right for you. And then the man answered, but it feels so right to me. And later I said to Swamiji, well, it feels so right to him because it's so comfortable. And Swami said, yes, he's just enclosed himself down. And subconscious in that case doesn't mean asleep. It just means familiar, known. And so, yes, it feels very right to him. So we have to learn not merely to listen to our inner voice, but we have to be able to discern which level it's coming from. And as I say, merely to do something different, sometimes people think it has to be intuition because it's such an insane idea. That doesn't mean anything. Sometimes, you know, you're just trying to rebel against what is, and so you'll choose an insane idea and it'll feel good to you. It's very subtle. Now, how did you phrase that question? The question was intuition and...
Is it same as God talking to you?
Sometimes.
How do you discern which one it is?
Now, that's a whole nother class, isn't it? It's not so easy. Yeah, it's not so easy. And it's a lot more grounded and practical than most people want it to be. Swami Kriyananda was, of course, more than anyone I knew, qualified to just say, this is what God wants us to do, us or him. But he never, ever did it in a flamboyant manner. He never said, now we're going to just throw over everything we've done because I feel God wants me to do this. He never threw us over a cliff, and he never acted without a backup plan. Even when he felt very strongly that this is what Master wanted us to do, he always had a backup plan. You know, he realized that even intuition, merely to be guided by God to do something, see, this is also where both affirmations and God's guidance people treat as a magic formula. Merely because God even truly asked you to do it does not mean it will succeed. It will only succeed if you put the energy out to bridge the gap between the revelation and where you're standing right now. I mean, Einstein saw that, but he had to bridge the whole gap. And I've certainly been in situations where I could feel that this was the right direction, but we weren't going to get there just by my sitting and saying, God wants us to do that. In fact, Swamiji said, he among the reasons why he underplayed the source of much of what he suggested to us was that he saw that if he made it seem as if this was either what he saw was going to happen or God suggested, he said people stopped putting out energy because they just thought, well, God wants it, Swami wants it, and we'll just sit here. And Swami said many wonderful things that God would give to this world never happened for lack of a willing human instrument. Meaning somebody, and a lot of what God would give to us doesn't happen. People come to me and they often say, well, I feel I'm supposed to be a healer, is what they often say, a healer, an artist, a teacher, this. Oh, so what are you doing? You know, what method of healing are you practicing? Who are you apprenticing with? What are you studying? You know, how are you preparing yourself? What are the obstacles that you're working to overcome? Well, no, I just feel I'm supposed to be a healer. And 20 years from now, they'll still be sitting there saying that because there's nothing in between. So, if you say, I like to say superconscious intuition, because superconscious intuition and the voice of God are getting closer together. But you usually find out step by step by just moving toward it and see what happens next. And this is where creativity comes in. Because one of the hard things about true guidance is that if it comes easily, that may mean it's true. And if there's nothing but obstacles against it, it may mean it's true. There's no rules. It's more, once you begin to act in an intuitive way, you have to remain extremely alert. Because also sometimes intuition will, for example, say, go to the corner, you know, go turn left here, and you say, okay, I'm supposed to go left. And if you start making all this noise about going left, you don't hear that in one block intuition says, now turn right. You'll have just made the dogma that I'm supposed to go left. And so it has to be a constantly creative process. What do I do now? What do I do now? What do I do now?
It's almost about how you listen. That's all.
It's about how you listen.
Hear it, it's there, but there's so much clutter that you just can't make it out. That's what I feel about myself, at least.
Yeah.
So you have to let it be heard.
Yes, and you have to... The largest obstacle to true superconscious intuition is the likes and dislikes of the heart. I want it to be a certain way. I don't want it to be a certain way. Or I want it to come to me through this particular method. And I don't really want to have to face that. And so we wait for intuition that matches our desires.
Yep.
And Swamiji himself said that intuition for yourself is the hardest thing. Even Swami himself said that it was very hard to be intuitive about himself. I jokingly say, how many psychics win the lottery? It often doesn't really work for you because you're just too close. Swamiji asked a lot of advice. He didn't always take the advice. It wasn't like he just did what other people said, but he would often ask a lot of people, you know, what do you think? And then he would listen and try to listen very neutrally. And sometimes what people would say would be contrary to what he knew was true, but it's... He said, I used to do writing for the publicity and so on like that. And most of what I wrote, Swami threw away. Mostly I would write it, I would bring it to him, he would read it, and then he would write something else. But he said what I wrote was helpful because it helped him know what he didn't want to say. So a lot of times we ask advice, and when we hear what other people are suggesting to us, literally it actually helps clarify how important this is to me. When I hear you say it, then I suddenly realize, no, that's not really where I want to go. Whether they're agreeing or disagreeing, it helps clarify it. And holding ourselves still from our preferences is just the hardest possible thing, and above all, our fears. This is the way I use the word subconscious. I mean, it's an English word that has other meanings, but that's how I'm using it, yes. It's what's already been programmed in.
Yes.
Well, that's the global question. That's the entire question of the spiritual path. So there's no... I can't answer that question. The question is how to progress spiritually, and it's absolutely every aspect of the path. It's meditation, it's prayer, it's discipleship, it's devotion, it's just in this moment. And this brings us back to where we were, but I want to get the other questions. It's like, how can I be creatively in tune right now?
And you start doing it
It, and you do it, it, there's no like this is how it's done. It's like, you know, I woke up this morning, you know, what choice should I make? I have a conversation right now, what choice should I make? It's you don't do it on in a broad sweep. You actually do it a minute at a time, because it's every one of those minutes that actually determines the flow of your energy. It's not the big conversations. It's what happens. I mean, I used to have a lot of faith in the big conversations. I don't have any faith in them anymore. you know, I'll talk to someone and they'll have a big revelation and I'll have a big revelation and, you know. And then, I mean, it's not that it means nothing, but I say, yeah, let's wait and see. Because what really happens is the next time I want to get angry, do I still get angry? The next time I feel really frustrated, do I still take my frustration out on someone else? The next time I want to deal with this by drinking two beers, do I just drink those beers or do I do something else? That's really when it comes down. It's not what you can say like this and how desperately you can make your proclamations. It's when it's just right down to it, you know, and what you do here. And so the spiritual path is the path of Kriya Yoga is not very dramatic. And as a consequence, a lot of people underestimate it. You know, because it's just... And Swami has trained us not to make a big noise. We just kind of quietly go about our business. We just quietly go about our business, minute by minute, trying to choose the higher road. Whether you're working in an office, whether you're, you know, doing something on your own, whatever you're doing, it's just like minute by minute, what choice do I make here? Where do I direct my consciousness? And that's a month from now, a year from now, a decade from now, that's who you become. And there's no... And how do you know what you're supposed to do? Well, it's generally pretty obvious. We think it's complicated when we think of it in this big abstract way, but it isn't. Because it's usually just about right in this moment, who am I blaming? Where is my happiness coming from? That's always just, do I think that my position is caused by whatever, or do I recognize that my state of mind is mine? And that, and yes, a very dull job is a big obstacle. You know, a disharmonious relationship is a big obstacle. A huge financial obligation is a big obstacle. And one thinks somebody else's karma would be easier. And so often we'll just like choose somebody else's karma and pretend that that's ours. So, Manol, you had a question.
All right, it's a little bit different.
That's all right, let's just go where we're going, because this actually took us off.
Going back to, let's say you want to be an artist, you want to make a living being an artist.
Right.
Meaning that this is what you want to do most of the time and support right. yourself financially, etc. There comes a compromise where you have to, like you said with Michael Jackson and everything, you have to produce art that is on a certain consciousness or level that people understand. So you have to cater to what's going to enable
right.
you to make a living.
Right.
And at the same time, you might be on a different level. And
yourself.
The art you really want to make, might be something that's not understood and what may enable you to be an artist full time. And there's that conflict.
Right.
How do you reconcile those?
First of all, I have to say I'm entirely unqualified to say because I've been at an ashram since I was in my early 20s. I've never seriously had to cope. Although I feel that I could. I believe that I could, but I have no idea. So let's go to several different levels here. There are several principles. There's three principles that are actually the key to Ananda's success, which are really the whole. Because Ananda's actually been quite successful in doing a creative work. I mean, Ananda didn't exist. Swami Kriyananda was 36 years old. He'd been kicked out of SRF. He'd been a monk for 14 years. He'd been forbidden and prevented from having contact with anyone that he knew. And he knew no one except SRF members, and he was prohibited from contacting any of them. He was living in his parents' house. He was penniless. And he created it all. Everything. And, you know, he did it. I mean, we helped him, but he did it. It didn't exist. He just tuned into his master and he found it. And then he worked. I mean, like, he worked like 40 people. He worked unrelentingly for the 60 years that he was a disciple. He never stopped. Never. I saw him in many circumstances, and I don't believe that a single day ever went by when he didn't do something creative and something serviceful. And by creative, I don't mean necessarily that he wrote a book or a song, although sometimes he did, but that he just looked at life and asked the question, what else can we do? And he, but the principles, and there are several things, I have several threads running here. The principles upon which Ananda is built, the first one is, where there is Dharma, there is always victory. And that means that if you're loyal to the highest principles, to truth, then it always works out. Now, does it always work out right away? Not necessarily, depends on your karma. But you will never succeed if you compromise Dharma. Now, Dharma is not just what I want. Dharma is that action which will bring me to a higher state of consciousness. Because sometimes, for example, and I was going to say this a long time ago, I remember this now. The lack of spontaneity in my parents that annoyed me when I was younger and just wanted to be so spontaneous, I realized it had been caused entirely by the birth of their children. That prior to their responsibility for us, they could do anything they wanted. And so there I was, blaming them for what I myself had caused, which seemed very unfair. You know, and my father had, he got trapped for about 20 years in a very uncongenial career, and then he switched to something that he enjoyed more, but he never really got to do what he wanted to do. He was really designed to be a college professor, but he was drafted early in World War I. And by the time he was out of the army and should have gone back and into academia and gotten his degrees and so on, at least my brother was born. Maybe I was already on the scene too. And my mother just wasn't willing to make the sacrifices required for him to do that. You know, in retrospect, I think it was highly unfortunate. She should have, because it kept him sort of outside of where his heart really wanted to go. At the same time, my father really loved my mother. They had 56 years of, you know, they were very, very devoted to each other. And my father took very good care of us. So what was Dharma? You know? He had something he never really got to do that I wished for him. I mean, only when I got much older did I understand that. And I finally asked him, you know, why didn't you just go back? You had could have gone on the GI Bill. You could have gotten a PhD. You could have done this. He just said, without a lot of blame, well, your mother never wanted to. I knew my mother enough to know why she didn't want to. She just was a little willful. But he knew what he was doing. He wasn't resentful. And it was Dharma for him. And, you know, when he died, I feel like he had a successful life in his own way. It didn't succeed in certain things that you could have laid out, but he followed Dharma. It wouldn't have been Dharma. Yes, go ahead.
Is he still going to have to do that eventually, fulfill that desire that he never...
Oh, yes, I'm sure that he will. I'm sure that he will. He deserves to have all of that. And or it was just so old that he really did need to move in a new direction. Who's to say? At the end of his life, he accidentally started making quite a good bit of money, which has been very helpful to me and to Ananda. So I'm very helpful for that. So who knows? You know, it all sort of plays together. So don't ever compromise your integrity for the short-term gain. But Dharma is subtle. And the second one is what we always talk about. People are more important than things, which is much more important when you're working in a community or managing others, which is don't let bottom line project values cause you to mistreat people. You have to be loyal to the people and think of their best welfare. That's more tricky if you're in a corporate situation, which is why Dharma becomes tricky. Because if you're responsible for your family and you stand up for some principle and you lose your job, and then what happens? So the third principle, which is not mentioned as often, is you have to be practical in your idealism. And where there's Dharma, there's victory, and to be practical in your idealism is the step that you have to see through. And maturity is being able to see a reality other than your own. That's how Swami described the goal of education for life, our educational system. True maturity is to be able to see realities other than your own. And those realities may be the realities of your children, the realities of your of your partner, the realities of your parents, whatever realities they may be, immaturity is just, I want my way. And I want everybody in the world and everything in the world to do it my way. And that's just immature. And immature does not work. Period. Because it's also, it's spiritually. You know, there are, your reality is something, but you are a part of a greater reality, and you cannot just draw a circle around yourself and demand that the world make it your way. If you have enough willpower and the karma, you can get away with it for a while, but ultimately it's not dharma, so it'll stop working. And so I think the answer to that question is similar to Deepika's question. You just have to go a step at a time. I mean, I think it's preferable to do something you like, even if it's commercial, so to speak, if it works. I'd just be practical in my idealism. I'd rather be in my wood shop turning out the same little widget all the time than working for somebody else doing something I really don't like, because I have to be practical in my idealism. The world is just not going to support me to do what I want. Yeah.
One last thing, I'm sorry.
No, not at all.
There's something else that comes into play, is what if you are so unhappy doing what you like that you become miserable to your family then? And you bring the bad energy home, then you're affecting them. You could be supporting them by holding on to the job, but because of how you
feel,
potentially come to resent the job or whatever you're doing, you carry on a lot of bad energy that you dump on them, right?
Well, this is,
there's also that.
This is very tricky karma.
Yeah.
And this is what is dharma here. And then you have to find out whether you have choices. And what the consequences of those choices are. And then you have to be mature enough to see the consequences of those choices, take responsibility for them, and then make hard decisions. You know, people leave their families, people leave their marriages, people leave their careers on the belief that this is going to work out, and sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. But the lack of maturity is really a very key factor in there, and that's why Swami's, you know, true maturity is the ability to relate to realities other than your own, is also a very important principle of life, is maturity. A lot of people are very immature. Immature in the sense of, I want it to be this way. Just like, you know, a little child. I saw this little child when I was traveling once. He was about 3, and, you know, we were on some international travel, and the poor lad had just been, you know, dragged through airports for hours and hours, and he was just in that state that kids get in, just kind of hurling himself around in his little stroller. And he didn't have language, but you could hear what he was saying. I feel terrible. Somebody do something. You know, somebody do something. And I recognize myself. You know, I feel terrible. Somebody do something. But there's a certain point, and I have to say this, I say this with a great deal of compassion. You know, nobody's going to rescue you. And the way out of whatever hole you're in is often extremely challenging. And what choice do you have?
At least you're moving forward and doing something about it.
Yeah.
You just have to be realistic about what you might face. But
what you might
face. It's
better
than inaction of just sitting and doing nothing.
Yes. But you have to be practical in your idealism, and you have to realize what you're risking sometimes. And I don't have a romantic answer for it. It's tough.
Oh no, I wasn't expecting.
I'm just saying. But I'm very sympathetic to you. Have to go step by step and just see where it takes you, and see where you're going to end up. And then, as Kamal was saying, try to be doing something you also enjoy. If I can't move the bulk over here, what can I add in here that'll help compensate it for it? I mean, of course, meditation is very helpful, because then you're directly affecting your state of consciousness. Of course, satsang is very helpful because you're directly affecting your state of consciousness. You know, music, artistic, creative things, long hikes in nature. You just need to sort of list it all out and think, what are the movable parts here? And what can I do with the movable parts? Instead of constantly throwing yourself against the immovable part, there's something that also is, energy has its own intelligence. And if you can change the magnetism in one place, I mean, a family or a life is like a solar system, which is you have all these orbits and everything is calibrated just exactly so to keep everything in its orbit. And if any major part of that shifts its orbit, then everything else is going to change around it. So if you have to ask yourself, you know, what can I play with? What can I shift just a little? And even sometimes when you don't think that that shift is going to make much difference, if you shift even a little, the whole solar system will begin to shift around you. You know, to just promise yourself that you'll exercise regularly, or you'll drink less alcohol, or you'll meditate more, or you'll go to Sunday satsang, or whatever it might be. You make a resolution to bring in something that will positively change the magnetism, even though it appears that my stomach is making so much noise, even though it appears is it will have no effect on the big concrete block that's the big issue, it will. I call that doing your dharma in a vacuum. It's like this dharmic action appears to have no relationship to any of the problems I'm facing. But if it's the only thing available to you, then you start pushing on it. Because that's better than just sitting there thinking the whole thing is more than I can handle. I had a woman friend once who was just in such a mess. Everything in her life was a mess. And I said, what do you enjoy? What's left that you enjoy? She says, I really enjoy riding my bicycle. I said, ride your bicycle. She said, but you know, I'm going bankrupt, I'm going to lose my job, you know, my kids are this. I said, ride your bicycle. So whenever all that stuff starts coming down in your head, just get on your bicycle. So, you know, it sounded crazy, but she did. But what happened was she started moving positive energy somewhere. And what started happening is, first of all, she felt better after she rode her bicycle, so when she came home, she behaved better. When she started having good ideas when she was out riding her bicycle that actually began to relate to what she was doing. But what she had done was, you know, what will lift my consciousness? And riding the bicycle had no relationship to the problems, but it was dharma because it lifted her consciousness. And so sometimes we just have to start a little bit like that without trying to go too far and say, where is this really going? As long as it's not foolhardy or detrimental. Does that make sense? You know, everything about our society is very out of balance. There's just no, this is what we chose to live in, a very uncongenial atmosphere. You know, families used to, you know, even if a man had to work, he worked in a place that was accessible to his family. He would go home to lunch. His children would come and bring him his tiffin. You know, you were integrated. Now we just go like this. And you're somewhere completely separated from the things of your heart for hours of the day. Then you try to come back together. I saw a friend of mine. There was a reality television show. And a friend of mine, her cousin, was one of the characters. And so she had us watch it. And it was these five families or three families. I went out onto the plains of Montana or some really wintry place. And they had to live as if they were pioneers there in the 1860s or something like that. And they could only have those things that were there at that time. And well, there's two aspects of this that are fun. And then they were going to be judged on whether or not they would have survived the winter according to how much food they had stored and so on. And they were allowed to bring in one item of their own choosing that was authentic to the time. So this one family that came was a very wealthy family from Southern California. They lived in a 10,000 square foot house, and they moved into this little cabin, the parents and three or four children. And the guy was an entrepreneur. He was a hustler. And so the single item he brought in was a still to distill whiskey, to make whiskey. And in the end, they determined that his family was certainly going to die because they didn't have enough of this and this. And his response was so interesting. He said, not a chance, we would have made it through. And he would have made it through. For one, he had the still. He could have traded whiskey for food the whole way through, and he knew it. And the other thing was, and this is, he had the creative determination, he was going to find a way. And unlike any of the others, he was a self-made man. Now, but what I was really going to say was, after, because they all lived in this cabin for 5 or 6 months. And after they went back to their 10,000 square foot house, the mother said, "I said, it's very lonely again," she said. "Each of my kids has their own room, and they're all in their own room, and my husband gets up in the morning and he goes off and he doesn't come back till night." She said it was much nicer like that. So a lot of it is what, you know, what is of value to us, but we're working against, we are really working against the grain here. I mean, cooperative communities are one solution and a very good solution, but we don't have here in Palo Alto the whole home job church in one place kind of atmosphere like is Master's real ideal, where we band together and buy land and then support ourselves in a very simple manner by having our own land and our own garden and so on. We're, you know, we're doing bits and pieces, but it a very radical change is necessary for this really to work. And I say that just, you are working against very hard situations. It's not all your fault, but it's all your responsibility, because here you are. So you have to just really think creatively and work together and figure out how you're gonna go from here. Does that help?
Yes, thank
you. Yeah. It's not a quick fix, but at least it's an answer. Okay, Anna Kaiser, you had a question or two?
I don't know if it's a silly question, but when you were saying how, again, Michael Jackson, and he's at the right at that level,
uh-huh.
and then when you pass that level, it's kind of forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
So what if you have a person, like I like to listen to old school hip hop, for example.
Uh-huh.
So like, what if a person likes to listen to the old stuff? Does that mean that they're kind of still on that level?
Oh, no, nothing is in a straight line. And actually, our society is, I think, is on a straight line, but it's a downhill straight line. I think the more you like the past, the better off you are right now. I was laughing. Swamiji, somebody asked John Lennon, "Do you think the Beatles' music will last?" And apparently he said, "No, why should it?" And Swamiji said he really liked him all the more for him saying that. You know, he didn't have any pretense about what he was doing. He was just having fun. He'd hit the right place and he was having fun. But I don't think things are so clear-cut. Because, see, everything has a vibration, and whatever that vibration is, you like what you're in tune with. I, myself, have found a great deal of peace recently by recognizing that the entire society, as far as I'm concerned, is just an alien civilization. I've spent too much of my time thinking that there were ways that I could actually connect to it. And it's not like I don't enjoy things. I mean, I do enjoy things. I enjoy a lot of what goes on in the world. It's not like I am miserable all the time. But I finally really just accepted the fact that the civilization into which I have incarnated is not my civilization. I'm here on purpose, partly to bring a message of another option. Well, not partly. That's really why I'm here. But I'm much more relaxed now, because I don't feel the need to rail against it as much as I've been railing against it. And, you know, now just thinking of American politics at this particular point, my, this is really something that we're facing. And this could be really awful. We just don't know where we're going with this. Swamiji said many times that a country gets the leader it deserves. And in our country, you know, the question is, what is our karma? What is the karma of America right now? Master also said there would be world conflagration. And so maybe, you know, maybe our next election is going to bring about that conflagration by giving us a dictator. And that dictator is going to just blow our system to pieces. I mean, I see too many indicators that could really happen, because too many people are being extremely stupid about what's going on. And I don't mean that people are supporting the wrong candidate. I mean that people are not, they're not understanding how power really operates, you know. Yeah, they're just, they think that everybody's going to play by their rules. And, you know, once Ananda was in litigation for a dozen years, and we had this attorney litigating against us who was a very evil man. There's just no other word for him. That's the word Swami used too. And he just figured out that all the lawyers played by certain rules, but there wasn't a reason you had to play by those rules. You would just play by completely other rules. And once you started playing by those other rules, basically you could just cut a clear path through. One of them very simple. Even the assumption that you would tell the truth. He just looked at it and said, why? If lying serves my cause better, why would I tell the truth? Because the whole legal system is a gentleman's game. And the enforcement procedures, when you just blatantly lie, are extremely slow and extremely cumbersome. So the reason why you don't lie is because you have some moral fiber. But if you have no moral fiber and just are there for yourself, and so this man just, you know, cut a swath through righteousness. Swami got it right away, because Swami's realistic and he's been a king for many incarnations. He just looked at it and he saw what was happening. The rest of us were just incredulous for so long, we made ridiculous decisions because we couldn't believe it. What's happening in politics right now is we have a man who just has figured out that he's playing a different game by different rules. And all the people are just piously intoning the old rules as if it matters a damn. And it doesn't.
It's really not that different from Hitler. And
it's exactly
Nazis.
Like
it's,
yeah.
It's like exactly the same thing.
It's exactly the same thing.
It's just that he can't believe
he was okay. He's like, yeah, the words are still true. What's the problem? Like, even if Mussolini said that, it's
amazing.
Well, and all of us on this side feel that our moral outrage has some relevance. And so I usually don't vote because I just feel that I don't really know anything or trust, but I will vote this year.
Yeah, I think everyone has to.
Yeah, everyone has to this year. I feel like it would be irresponsible of me not to, because this is, and people don't learn from history, but just the same sort of moral outrage, this is, Master said himself about Gandhi in India. He said, Gandhi succeeded because the British fundamentally believe in fair play. And when he stood before them and all his people stood before the British without weapons, the British simply could not continue. They started, but they could not continue to assault someone who wasn't defending himself because it just wasn't fair play. He said in Russia he just would have been dead in the first week. You know, it's just a different mindset. And so, yeah, so we're coming into a situation where our basic naivete and the arrogance of people who've had it their way for a long time, and it's their arrogance also that's really bringing this about. It's their belief that they're untouchable, and they aren't. Nobody is. Now, this is either terrifying, which it is, and or it's very interesting. In light of the fact that Master says we're moving from Kali into Dwapara, and that Master said repeatedly that it will not be business as usual. At some point, there will be a major shift, and that major shift will not come easily. So, is that what's happening? Is this really going to be the moment? Are people going to rally? And I mean, not that the other choices are any good at all. They're all, to my mind, just self-serving, greedy, undeserving.
That's how it works. I'm taking a poli-sci class right now, and I'm like,
this is why. That's why I don't vote. I just, to my mind, you know, this actually came to me, Kamal, the first time I went to India, because you were talking about population. The first time I went to India, which was 1986, and I looked out the window at overpopulation, which I had only heard of, in textbooks, and I was looking out the window at overpopulation, and I thought, wow, this is completely different than reading about it in a book. There's just way too many people here. And I also thought of the way we lived in America and how incredibly comfortable and wealthy we are and how lavish we are in everything we do. And if anybody wanted to, the whole planet could be run very well. But nobody wants to. It's just as simple as that. We don't want to. So the problem is not solar power or family leave or 5 weeks of paid vacation or immigration, the problem is consciousness. So I work on the level of consciousness, because if people begin to understand our relation to a higher reality, how to put ourselves in tune with that higher reality, how to act from that, Master said that is, that's the point. Whatever difficulties we have, whether they're economic, social, political, is because people don't know anymore. And we need, we're so karmically out of line because we no longer know our relationship to a greater reality. I mean, that's a neutral way to say it, but the real way to say it is we don't care about God anymore. It's just, we're just out for ourselves. And once you just recognize, I mean, there was a time when that was unthinkable. I mean, the whole world, whether it was the Catholics or whatever it was, but everybody lived in relation to a higher reality. A lot of it was fear of hellfire, but nonetheless, it kept you in line. But now that's gone. So why do we do what we do? And it's just become, well, if I can get away with it and if it pleases me, then why not? And that is such a crime against truth that it has to be ripped apart and put back in order. And it's not going to be pretty. However, one, we chose it. And two, maybe we'll all be living five in a small room and find that it's a lot more fun. Maybe this isn't such a good deal. We're just so accustomed to it, we don't see our way out. I've lived very, very simply and very cooperatively, and I think it's a much better way to live. And I have this feeling that once the dust clears, and it may not be a pretty scene while it's dusting, people are going to say, what could we have been thinking? You know, we were so divorced from ourselves. What were we thinking? So I don't know. If this man gets elected and if he ends up taking us into nuclear war, which he could, it could be really ghastly, but just be very interesting to see. And it's not... God is in charge. See, part of this is we have to do our part. Certainly, that's why I'm going to vote this year. Probably. But God is in charge. And this is where... Now, where does all this... This had to do with all that we were talking about. Wherever you're standing in the midst of that, you know, we are living in very difficult times. Harmonious solutions are not obvious. However, in very harmonious situations where you just went ahead and followed your father's profession or whatever you did and everything was, that also had its just stultifying monotony and absolute soul-stealing lack of individuality. So everything has its place. And this is just the particular one that we're dealing with. But it doesn't hurt to just say out loud, this is not really natural. You know, my chafing against this is not just that I'm an immature person. It's also this is not really the way human beings are meant to live, so what can I do to bring this into balance, given X, Y, and Z? You know, it's very strange because this is the consciousness center of the planet, this California area, and simultaneously it's this intensely over-materialistic, you know, driven, it's a very weird times. That's
so
all I can say.
In the midst of all of this, what you can do basically is take care of your own consciousness. Watch yourself.
First, take care of your consciousness.
Right. Try to be a positive channel and a good influence as much as you can. Because the thing is, we are a very small group of people.
We are so small.
It's going to be a long time before politicians or anyone else on a mass scale can do something, any sort of thinking like that. So it's unrealistic to really expect it. You just kind of have to be self-centered and
let
the rest of the stuff happen, because it will inevitably, more or less.
Well, that's sort of the position I'm taking, which is that I live in an alien... But Swamiji said several things about this which are fascinating. Many years ago, he said, in terms of reincarnation, in terms of what's going on in society, he said this like in the 70s, he said there, I think he said four or five karmic groups that are on the planet right now. One of them is, this was in the 70s when we were, I'll start here. He said one is the Romans, the people who ran the Roman Empire and just became so dissolute, so morally dissolute that the whole thing just came to pieces. He said they run primarily the entertainment business. He said the reincarnated Romans are running the entertainment business, right. Yeah. He said then you have the reincarnated Atlanteans, who were just so intent with science and manipulating the planet and so on. He said that they brought that culture so out of balance by their scientific manipulation of reality without regard for divinity, that Atlantis sank. Okay, and they're back, and they're fixing the world with science. You know, this is the genetically modified foods, and you know, just the pharmaceuticals, just everything where I can manipulate society without regard to divinity. With science, they're not stupid. They're just that's what they're into. Then the other group is American Indians, whose land was all taken away from us and were just brutally treated by America, who have this understanding of nature and the relationship to nature. And there's a whole bunch of them all over the place, and they're the ones who were saving the whales and, you know, the rainforest. And in the 70s, he said, in America, because a lot of us who were born relatively privileged were buying land in the country and going out and a lot of times putting up teepees and living like Native Americans. Swami said a lot of us were born rich enough to buy back our land. So we went out there and bought back our land and we're just living in our little tribal ways again. And then the other reincarnated group, it's four groups, are East Indians. He was talking about America, not the whole planet, but America. And these are East Indians like me. I'm both kinds of Indians, whose entire, you know, soul nature, so to speak, is much more in tune with Indian culture, not modern Indian culture, but true Vedic culture and all that that stood for in America. And he said, the Romans and the Atlanteans, and the Romans are also in politics. Yeah, the Romans are in politics and entertainment. Yeah. And they have all the apparent power. All the apparent power is in their hands. And he said, they're going to bring the society down again. They're going to destroy it as they have destroyed it in the past. This karmic patterns don't end quickly. And when people have a lot of energy and magnetism, it doesn't stop at one incarnation. You have all this force going forward. So these folks have a lot of force. So they're doing it again, he said, and they're going to destroy America again. The Romans are destroying it morally. You know, what you see on a television screen would have gotten you arrested like 20 years ago. And now you can just turn it on in your own house. It's just like so out there. And, you know, what they're doing to manipulate the natural world without any respect for the natural world is a crime. So the Atlanteans and the Romans are going to bring it all down again. And the Atlanteans, the Indians know that the Atlanteans and the Romans are there. We can see them, but they can't see us. They just don't see us. They don't know we're here. And they certainly don't think, even if they hear about us vaguely, that we have any power. But what Swami predicted is that after the Atlanteans and the Romans destroy it, he said, the Indians of both type are just going to stand up. And who's left of the other side is going to be just amazed at what we have. Because we are the future. But we don't have the power at the moment. It's a very interesting picture, isn't it? And when you take that and just apply it, it's what you see running all around you. And it's not our hour. But what we're doing during this time is we're cultivating ourselves, so to speak. And I don't just mean us as individuals, but we're cultivating our family, spiritual family. We're cultivating our understanding. We're cultivating our courage. We're just getting deeper and deeper into what we're building because it will be needed. That's the service aspect of it. And the other aspect of it is it's our nature. What else can we do? You know, this is what we were born to do. We were born to be this underground movement, really. You know, so no matter how hard we work on a very big level, nobody cares. You know, it's just nobody cares, really, in the power point of view. And everybody cares who's part of the reality of it. Now, I'll come back to creativity. The other, which I never have actually said, which I should say now, Swami said that creativity is essential for the spiritual path because the devotee must constantly ask the simple question, how can I serve better? And that's the spiritual path. How can I serve better? And whatever you're looking at, even if it's just the same old job, you know, how can I serve better? How can I be more joyous while I do this? How can I find other people to help? How can I serve better? Lord, here I am. What can I do better? And when you stop asking, how can I serve better, then your creativity dies. And when your creativity dies, all your freshness, all your prosperity dies with it. Your prosperity not necessarily just financially, but just your prosperity. How can I serve better? And sometimes the way you serve better is you just serve happier. And you serve happier just by, there's this little video that's going to be posted on the Ananda Living Wisdom School website pretty soon. And Rachel and Brian McSweeney and Rachel did it. I don't know if it's up yet or not, but Brian McSweeney, who made the film, also graduated from the Living Wisdom School here. He was our founding child. That's how we call him. And he said, you know, he's listed as an alumna. We had big this word, alumna, you know, whatever the right word is. I think it was determined that he's an alumnus. And he said, you know, among the things that he learned going to school here is how to have fun doing what you have to do anyway. And when you come down to it, that's really, I mean, if you think about that, if you can have fun doing what you have to do anyway, think how far ahead you are. And that's our message, is not that it's really going to get easier, because this is this plane of consciousness. And we find ourselves in this area which is not entirely congenial. And now that, as someone told me, Google has bought the Mountain View City Council, and the zoning is changing, and they're putting thousands more people on the same land and pouring them into the same roads, you know, everything about our life here is getting harder, just because it's of all of that. And more expensive and blah, 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 but here we are. So how can we have fun doing what we have to do anyway? How can I serve you better? You know, what does it mean to serve? It means to be a channel for the consciousness of God, which is love, peace, joy, calmness, energy, wisdom, divine sound, divine light, one of the eight manifestations of God. That's what it is to serve. So, and we can be always busy, because any time we find that we're not manifesting those, we have a job to do. And that job may not have anything to do with what your work is or who you're living with. It just, you're not doing your actual job. You're not following your dharma. Yes, we're going to take a break, but ask me one question.
I wanted to ask, who changes consciousness?
You have to be practical in your idealism. Let me tell you what that means. Energy can shift energy, but lower energy will not shift higher energy. If there's more energy in a certain direction, your low energy, no matter how well-intentioned, won't affect it at all. Swami Kriyananda's dome used to just leak literally like a sieve. The only reason it doesn't leak now, the Crystal Hermitage Dome, is because there's a roof over it. He told us for years to build a roof over the dome, but everybody kept trying to do something else. And no matter what we did for those first years, it leaked so badly that he used to have this trap door where you'd walk downstairs, walk down under the house where the wood was stored. But it was this trap door in the middle of the room. I mean, it's very nicely done now, but the bones of that are pretty funky. And it rained so much in the house that we used to literally lift the trap door and sweep the water out. That's how wet it was in the house. And no matter what we tried, you know, painting and waterproofing and this tiniest little crack. And Swami, jokingly but truly, he says, "But Lord, I'm so sincere." You know, but it's like, didn't matter how sincere he was, the water was just going to come in. It was the nature of water to do that. And no amount of, oh, please don't come in, was going to have any effect on it. So we can, you have a force like Donald Trump or the people who follow him. It's a powerful force. And we just don't necessarily have enough money, energy to stop it, nor is it necessarily in God's plan to stop it. You know, peace and harmony for the world was a suggested thing that we all do together. And I think it's helpful. I think it creates a dynamic energy. Will it actually create peace and harmony in the world? I don't know. Will it create a vibration of peace and harmony for all of us who are doing it and help us to be an instrument of that energy? Of course. How it will actually affect is something quite different. You know, God's plan is not always, many, many, many great saints are martyred. You know, it's the picture is not the likes and dislikes of our heart, that this is how it's supposed to come out. Sometimes you do exactly the right thing, and the short-term result of it is not attractive. Well, it's Easter. Jesus is about to be crucified. Tomorrow he goes into Jerusalem, and the following week he's crucified. That's like not a very happy ending from our point of view. So part of the issue is, are we part of a greater reality, or is my opinion the only one that matters? Part of a greater reality. That's the key. And that's what we say in the Festival of Light every time. Okay, let's go back to creativity. That's where our creativity comes from. I'm part of a greater reality. I want to be an instrument of that reality. How can I serve? How can I serve? Swami did so much artistic work, but he always said, I'm not an artist. I don't care. He said, I don't care if I ever write another song or another book. I am a devotee and a disciple, and I ask Master, how can I serve? And because he was so talented, he could do all those things, but he wasn't doing those things. He was answering the question. He was responding to Master's answer to the question, how can I serve? It's just entirely different. Mother Teresa of Calcutta was like that. She did all that work with poor people, which in our particular age, everybody's very concerned about poor people, which is good because it's a nice antidote to the incredible all-pervasive greed of our times. So people thought she was great because she helped the poor. And then a very cynical reporter said to her, but these so-and-so agents can do a much better job of serving the poor. Don't you think, economy of scale would say that you should just turn the whole thing over to... And she said, I'm not helping the poor. And she's a very plain-spoken, I'm not helping the poor. The reporter was just like dumbfounded. She said, I'm doing what Jesus asked me to do. The implication of that is if Jesus said, forget about the poor, go do something else, she'd never look back. You see how different that is? So, we're saying, let there be peace and harmony in the world because partly, I think, because this is a time where we could get really scared. And so we need to sort of direct some of that. But we can't be doing it with the thought of, and therefore, this won't happen and this will happen. Because who knows? And so the world is the sphere that we can influence. But people are evil. When they blew up the World Trade Center, people were saying, we should just love the terrorists. So when we said, no. He said, no. First of all, your love is not going to touch them. He said, we need to be appropriate. We need to be realistic. He said, sometimes people just need to be stopped. He says, a mad dog needs to be killed. You can't just let it rampage. But in your heart, you can be acting for what needs to be done, not out of fear or malice. That's the difference. And that's what we're trying to cultivate here, is a consciousness of peace and harmony. But not a consciousness of cowardice. It's a big difference. But this is, I'll come back to creativity. You see, it requires great creativity to not just fall. And this is another aspect of why the devotee has to be very creative. We can't just fall into obvious attitudes. We can't just think, this is, how I'm supposed to be. I'm supposed to be light. I'm supposed to be nice. No, we have to actually think, what's actually supposed to happen right now? And where is Dharma? Tricky business. Let's take a short break and then we'll come back and finish. I just said to my father, because this was after Kennedy was assassinated. I said, which is now such ancient history, but it was a really big deal when it happened. And a few other, what by now seem like minute revelations of corruption compared to what's happened since. I basically looked at him and said, I'm just not going to join that world. It worked for you, it does not work for me. I'm not going to join that world. And that was that. But I see other young people saying, I'm not going to join that world. And I'm not sure they're wrong. They just could be born for something entirely other. And your sense that, this is not tenable, this is not going to last, could be just as easily just intuition. It isn't going to last, and something else completely is going to happen. And so lots of what you thought you were organizing for is just not going to be there. Or you're going to have to cope because it's going to be just the same. I don't know which alternative is worse. But we, above all, we have to, because I'm pretending we're talking about creativity. See? But seriously, the answer to all of it, if you think about it, is to have a creative response to whatever comes. Because a creative response looks at what you're dealing with now. I've been in Oregon for almost most of this month, and they have a community kitchen there, and whenever, like every Sunday night or something, they serve what they call best overs instead of leftovers, which I thought was a very creative answer. My mother used to call it, she would serve us what she called a Romanian dinner, which was everything that was remaining in the refrigerator. But when I used to cook, run a community kitchen, which was a long time ago, because that's what would happen, you just accumulate. And I always just really love opening the refrigerator and seeing what's in there and then making it up from what you've got. And cooking is a relatively small project, but an essential project. But everything is about training your creativity. You open the door of your life, you see what you've got, and you ask yourself, what tasty dish can I make out of what I've got? Instead of saying, I'm going to make a shopping list and go out and get the stuff and then make what I want. What have I got? And how am I going to work with it? And the more we consistently train ourselves to find a new approach with the same old ingredients, or to find new ingredients when we don't know where they are, the more, I mean, then prosperity, you see, becomes an attitude, which is, if I don't have this, I always have that. And if I don't have that, and I have none of it, then what can I do with this? And I mean, the problem with our society now is that we're not creative, we just spend money. You know, we just spend money all the time. And I had to come home yesterday from Oregon, and because it's the beginning of spring break, all the Southwest flights were sold out. I mean, I've never just gone online and everything is sold out like this. And I was on this just terribly inconvenient flight. And then I thought, oh, this is what money is for. And I went back and changed my ticket price. And all of a sudden, I could use money to get what I wanted. But a lot of times, we're only using money to get what we want. You know, we're restless. We go out and do something. But if we don't have money, we'll be creative. We'll just find ways to entertain ourselves. People used to entertain themselves all the time without spending money because they didn't have money to spend. And that's where we just need to keep working. What can I do to change my consciousness? What can I do to change my consciousness? What can I do to change my consciousness? Best way is, how can I serve? Then how can I serve? How can I serve my own consciousness? How can I serve the planet? And then, D, what new answers can I come in? When you start asking, see, a lot of time you ask the question about intuition and God's will. A lot of time we ask God to guide us, and we don't get guidance because we're asking a question God doesn't really want to answer or doesn't even have an answer to, because we're saying, how can I just stay in my ego and have everything just the way I want it and then have you tell me what to do? And he just basically says, I'm not interested in that question. There's no divine answer to that question. How can I keep my ego and have everything my way? He just doesn't have an opinion. It's sort of like the way I feel about politics. What's the point? What's the point in answering? It's not going anywhere. It's not my world. But if you start asking a question that isn't even, how can I get out of this job I hate, but is a question that says, how can I serve? And that's a partial answer to the question. Actually, it's the key answer to the question. If you want to do something artistic versus commercial versus this versus that, you just, how can I serve? And the value of making a painting that'll sell and repeating it and repeating it. One of my a friend of a friend, he managed to make his living making really nice pictures, big pictures of fruit. But you know, it's a kind of he's found a niche for himself, and he does it really well. It's just like, you know, because people are so freaked out about anything that actually speaks of values, but everybody eats, so you can get a really beautiful picture of a still life, we'll call it, you know. But nobody wants to see something that has a message, because that's the society we live in. But they're very, very attractive paintings, and he supports his family, and he'd rather be doing that than something else.
What if you paint them with the higher consciousness and you give them
yes, exactly.
And then people will hang it up in the restaurant or their home. But
yeah, exactly.
It might be fruit, but
how can I serve? How can I be creative? What can I do? How can I serve? That's the question you ask over and over again. That serves you as a devotee, and it serves the world, and it serves your creativity. Because if you say, how can I serve better? You're saying, what can I do that hasn't been done before? And Swami also makes a very strong point, which is that sometimes people think creative is to do something that hasn't been done before. But he said, to be original is the word he uses. He said, to be original is to act from your own point of origin. And your own point of origin, you can actually do something like fruit, but you can do it with an energy and a consciousness. And Swami always uses as the example, if you tell someone that you love them, that's about as unoriginal a statement as you can offer. I mean, how many times has that been said? But when you actually say it from your real inner self, it sounds like it's never been said before, because it hasn't. And so originality is what we're seeking. And originality means that you are connected with your own point of origin. And that becomes a personal choice. What am I doing with myself? What am I listening to? What's my music? What's my radio? How am I using my spare time? What am I reading? And you know, our answers are mixed. I've been in a situation where I've read a number of novels. Novels are my great weakness in life. Whenever I really don't want to be here, I read novels. You know, and I have to actually discipline myself. It's like a drug. So I try not to read, you know, I don't read really bad novels most of the time, but everybody has their point where you just go down and you have to just try to keep yourself above it, whatever it is. Comments, thoughts, or questions? Do you have any?
Many times we, I really want this.
Then don't bother, don't waste this time. I mean, you have to be sincere. If you're not going to, why would you? If you're going to ask somebody's advice and you've already made up your mind, don't waste their time. It's a moment by moment answer. Every moment you have to just stop and ask, "What is it? You know, what is the right thing right now?" And you have to be sincere. You know, I sometimes an option is too high for me, and I'll go in the right direction, but I can't take that road. And I just know that I can't.
So as long as you're moving towards that.
I just have to be sincere. You have to be authentic. You can't just get it from the outside and paste it on. This is how I should behave because this is how a good devotee would behave. You have to say, I'm not that good.
It doesn't mean you can't bring God with you into that situation either.
In that book, is it Miracles and Answered Prayers? Yeah, it's not the Swami book. One of the stories there about this man who the story starts, I can't remember whether he put his name on it. I think he did, but I don't want to say it because I'm not 100% certain. But I'm nearly certain he did. He says, you might think you can't be a dedicated disciple of a great master and a drug addict at the same time, but I'm here to tell you, you can be. It was just as simple as that. And he said, not surprisingly, my favorite saying of masters was, if you're going to do it anyway, take me with you. He said, I took that one very seriously and took Master to a lot of places I don't think he would have gone on his own. It's very sweetly written. And yeah, he said, that's what I had to do because I was powerless in the grip of the things that held me. But I was also sincere in my devotion. I just was caught between. And so he didn't pretend. He didn't say, should I do this or not? He just said, I'm going to do it. You're going to come with me. I hope you don't mind. And, you know, and he just persevered in that until things shifted. And then he felt miraculously lifted out of it, but not until he was ready. So, I mean, just, as I say, these are not, there's no philosophical answers to these questions. These are not philosophical questions. These are, who am I and what can I do kinds of questions. And we get pushed really hard. You know, we just get pushed to our limit, and we have to be pushed to our limit. I mean, I would prefer to stay within the zone that I can already function in. Yeah, I like that. But I'm not allowed to. And then when I'm pushed beyond where I want to be, then I have to go through a long process of, I recognize that this is a good idea, but I really don't favor it. Or I recognize that this has positive potential, but at the present moment, I don't like it, because it doesn't do you any good to be anything but sincere. This doesn't serve you. Humility and sincerity. Now, do we have any other questions or thoughts, or otherwise we're getting close to our last minutes here. I'm checking out a few minutes early, but I'm out of ideas. Does anyone else have anything else? I'm quite happy to go on if you have questions. What about you?
Many questions.
Okay, ask them.
Well, I guess.
Yeah, how can I serve? Well, okay, no, actually, you just asked it. See, sometimes, again, it really doesn't matter whether you quit the job or stick with it. It's like Swamiji put it once, kindly but frankly, most people have so many lessons to learn they can learn them in a lot of different ways. You have to be very highly advanced before your choices matter that much. And so a lot of time when we're again beseeching the heavens to give us a point of view, there is no point of view, because the question is, help me to grow. How can I serve? And then often what we think are the big questions are not really the big questions. It's, am I going to use this to love more and to serve more? We think that the circumstances will dictate it, and what will really dictate it is whether or not we've decided that we want to love more and serve more. And then how can I love more? How can I serve more? Then you'll feel yourself more inwardly guided, and often then the big external decisions will start taking care of themselves. Because once you're on a track where you're really doing something that has a higher dimension to it, then the relatively lesser decisions about whether you should marry and have children and what job you should do, relatively lesser decisions, just become obvious, or they just make themselves known to you. So there is no theoretical answer. Every situation has to be intuited according to the vibration, but you have to cultivate, you have to practice when it's easier.
So, in a way, you're saying it doesn't matter if it's A or B, it's your attitude and your consciousness, regardless of which one you choose.
Well, sometimes it's easier to have a good attitude if you choose A instead of B.
Right.
And so sometimes when people will come and say, what does God want? My first question back is, well, what do you want? Meaning that, what can you do? What are you capable of doing? Because sometimes we also want to pretend that we're so capable and we're so neutral that we can just do anything, when in fact we're way beyond neutrality. We're just compelled by our inner nature very strongly in one direction, and it's not a sincere question.
So it goes back to not pretending.
Not pretending. Yeah. But all of these things you have to practice when there's less at stake. You have to be authentic and sincere with God and with other people and with yourself when there's not much at stake. Because by the time there's a lot at stake, if you don't have that track sort of carved within you, it's too confusing when there's so much pressure on you to suddenly find it. So you have to learn to just be authentic and honest and humble, and just say, I'd like to be very forgiving of you, but the fact of the matter is, I'm still very angry. And if you are angry, you are angry. Now, that's not the same as saying, I love being angry and I'm going to stay angry. That's taking it another level. But it's just saying, I'm not capable of mastering my feelings. We need to work with what's actually going on. And when we get in the habit, this is where I started, of actually looking at the way things are, not being afraid to see what's really happening, and then try to see what's remaining in the refrigerator. But if we're in the habit of always saying, it's all the same to me, it just doesn't matter to me. We can go to the movies or we can stay home, it's all the same to me. We can have the fish or we can have the vegetables, it's all the same to me. We can listen to your music, we can listen to mine, it's all the same to me. And then all of a sudden it's big, and it's never been all the same to you all the way up till there, either because you yourself don't know yourself well enough. You don't know how to be honest because you were raised in such a way that you were never allowed to express it. I mean, give all of these different things. But you have to practice. You have to start practicing all of these little pieces so that when you're at do I do a natural solution or allopathic solution to cancer? You have some equipment to navigate this question. I'm just on that particular question, just interestingly. A friend of mine who did die of cancer, apparently when she was first diagnosed, she wanted to just try to heal herself. And Swami looked at her and said, "Do you have the concentration and willpower to heal yourself?" And she said, "No, sir." Because it wasn't that it couldn't be done, but do you actually have that power? And she had to say, "No, I don't." And she wasn't going to be able to generate it right then. I mean, she died anyway because she was highly advanced before she even found it. But in the cancer, I mean. But that's just like the real question. Do I actually have the self-discipline to just go along with whatever you want? Or am I building up such a head of resentment underneath this that when it finally blows, there's going to be no saving it? And people build up a resentment against God because they're just always pretending that it's all okay. And then when God really does not answer one of your really big prayers, you end up just throwing the whole thing aside. I've just been 5 weeks with, 4 weeks, with this, you know, with this woman friend who's dying, who still has not stopped breathing. And we were just sitting at the table, and she's over here. We were sitting here, she's been here. It's you know, a hospice in the living room, just as it should be. And very profound and also very challenging. And I said to the breakfast table, "What if your faith in God was based on His giving you the answer to the prayers that you wanted? How really shallow that faith would be." I mean, here this wonderful woman is dying and she's not getting better, and she's prolonging her death. She's not even dying, you know, we jokingly, and I hope you have to understand this in the right spirit. There were some really great exit lines, just terrific exit lines, but they weren't her exit lines, you know, so we just went on like this. I mean, it didn't follow any of the script that we would have written ourselves. Just not even with so much profound attachment, fortunately. Just the script that I would have written. It was a very different script than the script we are still playing out. And I said, "What if your faith in God was based on Him doing what you wanted? How quickly you would lose your faith." So it has to just be built. But it's all right to say, "I really think this is a terrible idea, and I really don't know how I'm going to cope with this." Someone said to me about a situation, you know, I said, "Did you ask what Master wanted?" And the person replied, "No, because it doesn't matter what the answer is. There's only one thing I'm capable of doing." And I thought, it's a perfect answer. It didn't mean they weren't devoted to God. It just meant, this is where I am. People will come to me with that question. It's often a relationship question or a job question. I said, "Do you have any," and this is my, that's what I've always asked, "Do you have any creative energy left for this?" Meaning, is there anything that you can do to add to this? And when people actually tell me no, really, I'm at the end of my rope. Time to change. Because if you can't continue to be creative with it, you really are finished. You just need to go on, if it's miserable. But you have to have the integrity to be able to answer that and not just say, "Well, I should be able to." You have to have become authentic enough. You have to be at your own point of origin enough to say, "No, this is who I am. This is where I'm standing. I'm not proud of it and I'd like to be better, but this is where I'm standing." Yeah, hard questions. But this path is not easy. This path works, really works. It totally changes you. But slowly by slowly, as they say. Yeah. And you get back what you put into it. No magic formulas here. Not even discipleship. So on that very cheerful note, is there anything else that I can do?
I know it's hard.
It's not, you know, I know it's hard is true. I know it takes tremendous effort. But the alternative is so grim.
Yeah. Yeah.
That on the other side, no matter how difficult it is, this is the path of effortless joy. Because Swamiji tried to explain this to this woman who came to him and laid in front of him all her difficulties and why is this happening, why is that? And he kept trying to say to her, but because you're a disciple and because you understand self-realization, you realize that this is all going somewhere. And so regardless of what it is now, you know what it is and you know where it's going. And that just changes everything. So even if it's a tough hill you're climbing, I mean, I know where I am, I know where I'm going. And that changes everything. And that actually turns it into joy. Not effortless joy, but joy. No matter what. Yes?
Back to the resentment against
him. You know, the book Ask Asha turns out to have in it pretty much the answer to most of the really serious questions I've been asked on this over many years. I'm actually saying the book turned out to be a lot more important than I thought it was. I mainly just wanted a book that had my own name on it, my own voice, because I was traveling and I wanted something that, if you like listening to me, if you like this book, maybe you'll want to listen to me or vice versa. But the point is, there's two kinds of inquiry that we make. One inquiry is very theoretical. And when I was first teaching in India, Indian people like to ask theoretical questions. I like to answer practical questions. And we would have I had some very strange interactions until I realized that people just wanted to talk about it in theory. And I kept wanting to resolve it in practical action. And so we could never bring the conversation to a close because they just always had another question. And it got really goofy until I figured this out. So there's a great deal about what goes on in the world which you can be really upset about. But at a certain point, you have to ask yourself, what attitude actually brings a result that is useful to me? And so we can be really upset with God and say that there's no light here and that this is just awful. And we can do that for many, many incarnations, and people do. And what finally happens over the course of many lifetimes is the suffering becomes unbearable. And instead of just reacting and asserting, it crosses your mind to ask a different kind of question, like, what could be going on here? And this is actually in our Festival of Light every week, because the little bird is manifested by God and he's supposed to be selfless and serviceful. And then he starts having a really good time and he starts thinking about, how can I have it my way? And so what the little bird does is that he enters the stage which is called the revolt, which is, there is divine law, but I actually think that my system works better, which is, I want it to be my way. I want to have parents who love me. I want to be in a wealthy family. I want my career to work. I want my body to be good. I don't want to die young. I don't want my children to die young. You know, I want, I want, I want. And even when it doesn't work, we just keep saying, but I want, but I want, but I want. And it must be your fault, God. You must be doing it. And then at a certain point, even it says in the festival, even though repeatedly he lost everything he had, he just held to it, thinking that the next time it's going to work. This is called reincarnation. Until finally, somehow, it became so bad that he asked a different question, which is, what's really going on here? And that's called the quest. And we don't have the truth, but we're more interested in what is than trying to enforce our will upon the world. And when you start asking that, when you're ready to hear that answer, you start asking that question. And there's just no way to be in the revolt and also have knowledge. And the revolt is, there is no divine law, God is not good, it's self-evident, look at all these things that happen. And if you're determined in that point of view, you get to do that until it stops working for you. I had a friend who, someone died. Very well-to-do family, very socially prominent family, very positive relationship, positive family life, except, you know, this woman gets this dread disease and dies. Just sort of like wasn't supposed to happen. And there's no spiritual context whatsoever. And everybody was just in hell. It was just horrible. And I had much that I could have offered, but none of it would have been received, absolutely none of it. So it was pointless to do anything. And I was not enjoying myself, you know, because of all the misery. And then it crossed my mind, oh, well, that's right. This is what has to happen. Because it has to stop working. It has to stop working before people will move from the revolt into the quest. And right here, in this particular situation, it has really stopped working. Now, they're still not ready to ask questions. They're just going to reconnoiter and gather themselves all up again and just keep going with the revolt, because even though repeatedly they lost everything they had. But this is the process. So if you yourself are in a state of revolt, you have to just ask yourself, I was in a real tough spot a number of years ago, and a woman friend who had a lot of intuition, I asked her for help. And I explained to her how I was feeling, and she just so smiled so sweetly and said, and how is that working for you? I said, it's not working for me at all. She said, well then, maybe we should think about another point of view. But it was a perfect question. Well, how is that working for you? So there is no God, it's all dark, everything is miserable. How is that working for you? And when it stops working for you, you'll think of something else. So you just keep at it.
What about people that are in between? They're not revolting, but they're still alive.
Well, that's the quest. That's where most of us live. You know, we genuinely want the truth, but maybe only on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Mm-hmm. So we oscillate between those two points of view. We're just somewhere we're between the revolt and the quest. And that's why we do that festival every week. There's so much in just that little transaction. So then you have to stop and ask yourself, what am I, the way I put it is two ways. Why are you doing this to me, God? Or why are you doing this to me, God? Exactly the same question. But you elicit two entirely different responses. One is the revolt, one is the quest. And how is that working for you? That's what I ask myself. That's why I said, even though it sounds grim, the alternative is worse. How is this working for me? Well, this is really not working for me, so what other alternative is there? Or, for now, Lord, I'm having a tantrum, and I'm just going to keep on having this tantrum. I'm going to have it all day today and probably a lot of tomorrow, because I'm just, that's where I'm at. But eventually, for me, I can't hold the revolt very long, because I've been on the quest for too long. I can fall into the revolt, but I can't hold it very long. And when I hold it, when I'm in it, I'm conscious of it. And that's a lot. Anything else? Because we are now really actually at the ending time. All right. Thank you very much. Very interesting morning. Yeah, my pleasure.